Hey developers, your code's perfect, right? I didn't think so, and neither do the folks at Sentry.io. They know that sometimes errors can fall through the cracks in your testing system. Sometimes users give you error reports, but they're incomplete and don't give you enough information to recreate the problem. Well, Sentry is here to give you detailed, contextual information about every single crash in your application. Stuff like stack trace, the git commit that corresponds to it, the release of your application, and even the user who caused it. You'll get a breadcrumb trail that tells you everything the user did leading up to the error. And Sentry integrates with the deployment pipeline, so some errors won't even make it to production. There's first-party support for many client and server platforms, including a couple of DNC favorites, Vue.js, Rails, and even Elixir. So head on over to Sentry.io to give it a try. There's a free developer account, which is perfect for personal projects and early-stage applications. No credit card required. Sentry.io. Your code is broken. Let's fix it together. You know, it's been one of those weeks when, for both of us, really, when we go almost the entire week without talking once on Discord.
Yeah, I don't think I said a single word to you this week at all.
No, I don't think so. And you know what? We've both been too busy to even notice. Like, I didn't even realize it till today. I was like, oh, I wonder what Sean's working on. I have no idea because I've been pretty occupied myself.
The weeks have been just flying by recently. It's pretty wild. Paul and I are trying to slow down. I think since January, we've rewritten the entire shipping system. So, it's pretty wild. So it's probably irresponsible to be shipping that much stuff. It's hard. Like, we have automated tests. We actually are very closely about to cross the 1,000 test mark, which is kind of fun.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And 1,000 tests in, I don't know, like 60 seconds or something, which isn't terrible, but that's great. But there are some things that I need to work on. So I've been working on like getting a QA document set up. So there are a number of edge cases that are just always edge cases with our app. And so sometimes if you're in a hurry or you're just like making a big change, there's a lot of small things you need to remember to test. So I worked on like adding a document that has a list of edge cases and a list of things that we need to make sure that we test every time something goes, like something large goes out the door. And so it's been kind of heads down doing things like that, helping ourselves out, helping our future selves out.
And so like edge cases, are you talking about stuff that just can't be covered by tests? Or are you talking about like just like high level, like, hey, click around and make sure these things aren't broken? Like, is that kind of stuff?
Exactly. It's click testing. It's kind of like a script. Like, if you worked on a feature and it touched the pricing stuff, then make sure to test this receipt view and this receipt view. So it's kind of strange because we have some prices that are embedded into the price of a product, but a store doesn't actually see that money because they're not paying for the shipping. And so in receipts, they need to be aware that the user did pay for shipping, but in the totals, it shouldn't reflect, the price of the shipping shouldn't be reflected in what the store sees that they got, right? Whereas a customer would want to see the full amount that they paid, or like in an admin receipt view, you'd want to see both, for example. So maybe not necessarily edge cases. There's just lots of paths or lots of different places that we need to remember that things shouldn't be breaking. And what's really nice is that in the past few weeks, I've been able to do some refactoring that kind of cleans up a lot of those things. So a few episodes ago, we talked about kind of decreasing. Oh, it was the episode where we talked about like making large changes to your app. And one of the things we recommended was, you know, trying to reduce duplicated logic or try to refactor service area things down into a smaller point. And so that's one of the things that I was able to do is refactor a lot of the pricing stuff that had been spread out into one module. And so any of the views, whether it's like an API view, whether it's GraphQL resolver, whether it's like a email that's rendered on the server, that all just kind of pass pricing through that one module. So this week I did a big refactor on something, and 50% of the work was adjusting a module, and everything else was just kind of magically updated. But I still had to remember, like I still remembered to go through and click all that stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. Maybe we'll get into a little bit more of the details of that later, I think,
sure,
because I'm sure it's on your brain. And from what you told me, you're basically ready to ship it. So
yeah, I'm turning a new leaf, and I'm not shipping stuff on Fridays.
That's probably for the best.
And I'm not shipping stuff after 3 p.m. Those are the two things that I'm trying. It's not like a hard and fast rule. Like obviously hot fixes and stuff are different, but yeah. So it's something actually I met up with a friend of the show, Dave. It was actually the first time I met him. We had talked, he used to work for the Outline, and he's in New York, and, they do Elixir there, and he works for Simple. Shout out to Dave, working at Simple Bet. That's what it is. Anyway, he's working with Elixir and Rust now. And, I used to kind of like send him tweets and Slack messages in the Elixir Slack and just kind of asking questions. And so I got to meet up with him and I was explaining to him some of the stuff I was working on, and he thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I had a similar kind of thing happen. An old friend of mine from one of my old jobs texted me and says, we flew in our two remote contractors to hang out with our team for a couple of days. Their entire shop migrated from Ruby on Rails to Elixir. Phoenix had nothing but amazing things to say about it. Blah, blah, blah. Actually, one of the core contributors of Phoenix now works for this guy's shop.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'm like, oh, so you're working with Dockyard. He's like, yeah, it's Dockyard.
Yeah.
But it was just funny because he's always like, he's been pinging me on like once every 6 months, like, hey, how's Phoenix? Hey, how's Elixir? Do you still like it? Is it still good? And gave me a hard time for not writing any tests, which is deserved.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, it deserves scrutiny for sure.
But like he wants to make sure that the testing game is strong, because that's like a huge important part for his team. You know, I mean, he's mm-hmm. very, very focused on that. And like your testament to, you know, having 1,000 tests in a minute, like that's crazy. In fact, I should let him know about that, because that's, I totally didn't even think about that when I was talking with him.
They're not even like, I have put zero thought into making them fast. I have added the async tag to approximately zero tests.
Yeah, but I mean, that's great. Like, it's still fast enough, though. It's like, how often are you really running the full suite?
Multiple times every day.
Oh, okay. But still, like a minute. Like, I mean, again, it's all relative when you look at,
right,
you know, other projects of your size. Like, I'm sure you're fine.
Yeah, I mean, the last Ruby app I worked on, the test suite, I think there was 500 tests, and it took like 5 minutes.
Yeah, which, you know, who knows what, you know, what's in a test, really?
Exactly. But yeah, it could be, yeah, it's not necessarily a critique of Rails by any means, or Ruby by any means, but
it sounds impressive.
It's night and day. Yeah, it's pretty nice. I use mixtest.watch, I think it's called, just to auto run tests, and I have it, I have an alias mixt, so that'll start up mixtest.watch, and it'll append the stale flag, and so whenever, that's basically what I just have running all day long. So I have my Phoenix server running, and then I have the stale test running. Every time I make a change, it'll run any stale tests associated with that change.
Yeah, that's great. And that mixed text watch is a third party library, but for being honest, I think it should be it should be rolled into the real thing, because it's so useful.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. I like it. It's easy to use. I mean, XUnit's great. I have reached for a zero, like add-ons, I guess you could say, for anything with that. So it's just.
Are you still using Ex Machina?
Oh yeah, I guess that's the only thing that I use aside from that. But I use Ex Machina quite a bit.
Okay, but but that's super lightweight, and in theory, like, you don't really need that. I mean, you can do most of what that does with just plain old Ecto these days. So
yeah, you could pretty much, like, if you look at the source of Ex Machina, it's actually really small.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. What were we talking about before? I feel like I just trailed off.
That's what we do. No, we were talking about
refactoring.
I distracted you. You're talking about a friend of the show, Dave.
Oh yeah, I think that's where I lost. I forgot what I was talking about before I started talking about friend of the show, Dave. So I remember talking about refactoring, and I remember. So is there anything that you wanted to talk about before I jump into this whole thing?
No, I don't really have a lot to say necessarily, other than I've also been insanely busy in a good way. I've been working on a new, integrating some new hardware in with our system. I think I've alluded to this last week, but basically it's like, it's going to sort of change the way that our business operates in terms of like the services that we can offer. Like, it's a whole new level. It takes it to the next level, like, you know, being cliche or whatever. It really, really is that big of a leap. And so playing with that hardware, doing a lot of reverse engineering hacking stuff together, working on the full stack of the application is like really, you know, triggered parts of my brain that are, you know, haven't been touched since we started the business. You know what I mean? This is our bread and butter. This is what we built the business off of, is like what feels like a pile of hacks and hardware integration and web integration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting. It's exciting because like the potential outcome for us is really, really huge. And I just got to see it through to the finish. So I'll have more details on that as that develops. But in the meantime, the way I described this to my coworker was, it feels like I've taken the whole application, thrown it up in the air, reassembled it before it like lands on the ground again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like that's what it feels like. Cause I've got to write new, you know, drivers basically on the station end to talk to this device. I've got to add a bunch of stuff to the sort of our Phoenix server to, you get everything talking. I've got to update the UI and Vue. I've got to update this helper app, which we have, which is an Electron app, because we need sort of native features as well. So like literally today at the end of this week, I committed to 4 separate repos in like the course of, you know, 2 minutes.
That's awesome.
Phoenix, a Ruby app, Nuxt app, and the Electron app. And the only one I didn't touch was actually the Rails app, because that doesn't like matter for this. So it's like it's a lot of moving pieces. It can be frustrating because the way everything fits together, it's like everything's so asynchronous and disconnected, right? Everything's done over WebSockets. Everything's you know, it's syncing up state, it's making sure that everything, like everyone agrees before like we can do certain things, right? Authentication is a big one.
Right.
You know, when you've got all those moving pieces, like how do you make sure that everything is in sync? And plus all the just legacy, the way the system grew organically over time, was like, did not anticipate all these extra edge cases. And so it's actually really funny, because digging into pieces of code that I haven't touched in a long time, like I made some abstractions way back in the day that were kind of anticipatory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say premature optimizations, but like they're abstractions that I thought were going to pay off at some point. And well, like it's about 50-50 now that I'm going and like trying to use them.
Yeah.
Some of the abstractions like, oh, this fits in perfectly, and I just wire it in and add my new thing, a new case, and it just freaking works like the way you expect it to. And other times it's like you've written yourself into a corner because you didn't anticipate a particular way you wanted to use that part of the application. And that's frustrating, because then it's like, okay, do I spend the time and refactor this so that it's correct? Do I just hack on something to get it working and then refactor it? Do I hack it and just leave the hack? Like you know, I mean, you know what the right solution is, but it's, you know, again, it's the time versus, you know, you've got momentum and trying not to kill that momentum, because I don't plan things maybe as well as you do in terms of thinking of every possible scenario before I attack the problem. But
I don't know about that. I guess it's a different problem space too, a little bit, especially if you're working with an outside vendor and you have a certain set of unknowns. I think it's a little bit difficult, or more difficult rather. We don't really have a lot of unknowns, technically speaking, so it makes it a little bit easier to try to consider. I think like most of the stuff that we've been battling is just kind of tech debt or like architectural decisions that were made, you know, before either Paul or I were around and are just there and exist. So it's like trying to reconcile those and kind of wrangle those is where a lot of my difficulty comes from. But I haven't really had a whole lot of technical unknowns, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, working with third-party APIs can definitely be a source of that. Like, for example, you know, with your shipping APIs and stuff like that.
Yeah, thankfully they've been pretty okay. I mean, UShip's, like, the documentation could use a little work, to be quite honest. But we have an account rep, and at least that person's responsive via email, which is nice. EasyPost is just, it's their documentation is great, and it works as you would expect. So I think like the hardest things we've had to work, this is so funny, Rockwell, the hardest things we've had to work around are just UShip's API limits. So their test staging API has a API request limit of like 2 per second, and their production's not much higher. So I've had to do some things to like mitigate some problems there. And I guess another one too is Elasticsearch, because we use that for our searching. And The plan that we have right now doesn't support, or it doesn't have concurrent indexing enabled. So that's caused me a little bit of grief, like making sure that whenever we have to reindex products, it's done one by one, unless we want to pay way more money. But even then, it's not like exploratory, I guess. It's kind of like, oh, the documentation is here. It's kind of a set thing that I have to work with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but that doesn't always mean it's going to work the way you expect it to either.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've read plenty of documentation that is basically 90% crap. They're just like, this is not even how it behaves.
Yeah.
I'm literally decoding like binary TCP protocols with this thing. And it's like, oh yeah, no, this doesn't match documentation at all. I have to figure it out what the numbers actually are. Like stupid stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
One thing that did kind of strike me was, as for planning this feature, what I did was I made a flowchart, or basically like a block diagram in OmniGraffle, outlining all of the different pieces because it is so all-encompassing. And what struck me was, like, I marked every block with the technology that it was built on as kind of just a communication, like, tool, right? Like, hey, this is the Ruby thing, this is the Nux thing, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me how, like, every layer of the application is something different. Right, I've got Electron app, which itself is a whole pile of things that you have to know, because Electron apps are weird because they have like the node process, but then each browser has a node process that's like a browser, and like the node process can do some things that the browser can't, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And they communicate through inter-process communication, so you've got like basically a TCP socket there, like that you have to talk about just within the own application. Then I've got this hardware with its TCP and UDP protocols that I had to implement. Then I've got Nuxt with Vue.js. Then I've got WebRTC with Stun and Turn. I've got Ruby server. I've got Phoenix, obviously. And then like I have this Swift WebRTC peer that I wrote, which I think I might just use Node.js for. I don't know. It just, I think I mentioned this before, how I looked at the stack of like Uber one time. They have a whole engineering article about it, and I was kind of laughing about how many crazy technologies they're using all to glob everything together.
Right.
And I'm looking like I'm just being a hypocrite, because I'm looking at this and like literally everything's different. Like there's no uniformity at all, and it's just I was just trying to figure out how I should feel about that. You know?
Yeah, I remember reading the article too. I'll have to look it up, put it in the show notes, but that's funny, because I had a similar sentiment, like, wow, that seems like a lot of stuff. And here I am sitting, you're rattling off, that's a lot, like you have a lot of stuff you got going on too. And what's really funny is that Dave and I were walking up Lombard Street towards Coit Tower, because I was taking him up to Pioneer Park. And he asked me something, he asked me if I had complete control over the technology that we're using, or like being able to make decisions, like we're going to use this tool or that tool or whatever. And I said, yeah. And then I said, like, what I always say, like, I'm just trying to keep it to Elixir and Postgres as much as I can. And then I was like, oh, well, then we have Redis. Oh, and then we have a PHP microservice for bin packing. Oh, and then we have Elasticsearch, you know? So it just kept on like building and building. And it's kind of funny how, I guess, that just sort of happens.
Yeah, it definitely is organic. And like you, as the person who developed it, you made the decisions, you learned about it, like you made an informed decision about to use the thing, and you know kind of the ins and outs of it. But taking a step back or trying to introduce it to someone, it can definitely be daunting.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's just, honestly, it's just really like the state of the art. Like that's the way things are built these days. Like if you want to justify it to yourself that way and say like there's no application that's not built like this. Like if you did, it would just be a walled garden and it did nothing, right?
Well, it'd be like this awkward Swiss Army knife, right? Like that Swiss Army knives are useful, but they're not the most elegant tool to be using to solve any specific problem.
I was thinking more of like a unitasker. You imagine like a kitchen, you know, like those kitchen gadgets that do like exactly one thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like my mom gave me a pineapple slicer core thing. Like you literally put it in the pineapple, push down, take it out, and then it just like out comes perfectly sliced pineapple pieces. But you know, you could do that with a knife that you could do anything with, right? But
right, I guess it's kind of like finding the sweet spot, right? So like if you're gonna be I guess if we're sticking with the cookie metaphor, like one thing that Paul always tells me is to avoid unitaskers at all costs, right? So like a waffle maker, waffles are awesome and I like them more than pancakes, but it only makes waffles, you know? But at a certain level, like I can't make a waffle with a pan or a skillet or something. You need a waffle maker to make a waffle, right? And so at some level, if you have to have waffles, you need to have a waffle maker.
Sorry, it just sounds so ridiculous, but I can't think of a better analogy.
Yeah. Postgres can do plain text searching and stuff, but Elasticsearch does it on a more advanced level. So that was a natural fit. It added a lot of moving parts to our system. Like I just mentioned, a pain point in which is purely just a money thing. I just don't want to spend the more money for the concurrent re-indexing, and we don't necessarily need it. But it's a kind of annoying thing because I'll use task or something like that, and then I'll remember, oh, once we're on staging, you know, I push it up to test it. I'm like, oh shoot, this is doing a concurrent re-index, and I'm just getting errors now, you know? Or like, so another thing that we do is if we're making calls to an external service, we'll usually have something that patches a message into Slack when it's done or if it went wrong. So it's not just silently failing. And so I'll push something up to staging and suddenly I'll see our staging robots going bananas or something. And like, oh yeah, I have to do this. So what's hilarious is that what I finally ended up doing was I made an Elasticsearch Redis queue with a concurrency of one. So it's limited to one job when something is in the queue, but it works and I don't have to worry about it.
That's pretty great actually.
Yeah. And so same thing for UShift. If something has to do if someone purchases something and there's three separate shipments going through UShip, it goes into a UShip queue that has a concurrency limited to one, just so that we can help maintain help know that we're just not going to be running into like API call problems. And I guess like once we get to that point, we'll have a scale issue. Like we'll be at scale, I guess, or whatever that means, at scale. We'll have a bigger scale than we have now. So that's a different issue to worry about then. But anyway, yeah, Elasticsearch made more sense for us because of the number of things that it supports. And recently, actually the last couple of weeks, because I've been doing some pricing changing, it's been great because today I was writing Java in Elixir and you're able to, I think they're called painless scripts with Elasticsearch. So if you have to do some manipulating of data before it actually goes to Elasticsearch, you can do that. And they have a dialect that's like a subset of JavaScript, and then they have something called painless, which is like a subset of Java. And so you're able to manipulate things before it goes over to Elasticsearch. But it
sounds like the opposite of painless.
It actually was pretty painless. It actually was pretty awesome.
Okay.
I'll have to link the docs to that. But yeah, that happens. I had to do that just because of like the pricing adjustment updates that I was working on refactoring. But anyway, I guess to like tie that off, like Elasticsearch for us is a pretty great unitasker.
Yeah, exactly. Like you could, you know, if you don't want the extra complexity, you could settle for Postgres plain text pancakes. Like that's fine. You know, it's almost a waffle.
Right. Yeah. It's almost a waffle.
But your syrup's not going to stay in those little containers, the little syrup containers.
Ooh, those little. I'm getting hungry now.
You said bananas before. Now I just really want like banana pancakes.
I don't think I've ever had a banana pancake.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So price adjustments. I mentioned that term. That doesn't mean anything to anyone else besides me and maybe you. So I also mentioned earlier some just like legacy decisions that we've been battling a little bit. And I think it was two episodes, maybe last episode, I kind of posed the question to you, like, what do you do when you're in a project and you hit the spot where you're like, I should have done this. And the answer was budget more time for projects or do it later, I guess. And so that's what I did. I talked to my boss and the next 3 months actually were scheduling maintenance and fixes and enhancements as if they were features. And which is incredible actually. And so this whole week I took the week and was refactoring some of the stuff that I worked on last week. Just to make things better and more stable and more reliable. And specifically what that means is I know some people have asked, like they want kind of a breakdown of what the products in the line items table looks like in Design Collective. And the reason I haven't done that yet is because they're not how I want them to be. They're not as nice as how I want them to be. And maybe that's just something I need to get over. But they're getting closer. And how things were working before was a product can have a base price and cents or sale price. So when a store owner wants to put a product on sale, they just enter a sale price value. And so at that point, then a product's price is either the base price or the sale price. Okay.
And those are individual fields or individual columns in the table.
Exactly. Yeah. They're in individual columns. And so far that works pretty okay. Now there's a joint table. So it gets more complicated for like sale pricing. So like when you're adding a product to a sale, like a flash sale, you wouldn't want that product to go on sale right now. You'd want it to go on sale when the sale is live. So we have different things that get stored on join tables and they get copied over to the product. Once the sale goes live, it manipulates the products that it owns essentially.
And when the sale ends, is it?
It moves it back. Yeah, it sets it back.
Return it. How does it stores the original price somewhere?
The base price. Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. So the base price is essentially the highest advertised price that a user will see. And the sale price is essentially the lowest advertised price a user will see. And so those are terms that I use in the API side, highest advertised and lowest advertised. And for me, it just made more sense than base and sale. It'll make more sense in a second. Okay. So then you fast forward and you're like, okay, well now there's going to be estimated shipping prices that can be included in the price of a product. Okay. So maybe the simplest way you can implement that is add another column onto your products table and you maybe call that estimated shipping price in cents. Okay. So now you have three price columns. It could either be the base price, the sale price, or depending on the store setting, because they can opt in or out of masking shipping prices into the price of their products. Or, you know, if that setting is turned on or off, it could also optionally include another column called estimated shipping price in cents. That seems okay up front. Like, it's not ideal. You're going to have to check the store setting. But it's passable, right? So you continue on, and that's fine. And then you start to add in, okay, well, now we have different user types. So you might have a user that might be like a trade, like an industry user, right? And they might get a specific discount that a store might give all users of that role type. Okay, well, now you're adding a fourth modifier into the mix, okay? And then you add discounts. So there's a fifth modifier into the mix. And up until this week, they've just been kind of living in different spots on different tables.
And you have something here called estimated shipping price insurance premium.
Yeah. That's another one. So there's a sixth multiplier or like modifier. Okay. So essentially, like, okay, what we're seeing is you have a couple of base prices, and then you have up to five, I think, price modifiers. Or
it sounds like a D&D stats sheet at this point.
Right. Yeah. And it could get a lot more complicated than this, and it probably will. Which is why I wanted to refactor this sooner than later, right?
It's just one number, Sean. How is this so complicated? The price.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody once, and they were talking to someone while I was talking to them, which maybe that makes sense to you. I don't know. But they asked me how many tables we had in Postgres, and I told them, and they're like, why do you need that many tables? It's like, it's e-commerce, man. It's the data. There's a lot of data. It's pretty spread out. But also, it's kind of partly due to, again, how the initial MVP was built. But anyway, so we go back to where we were. We have a base price, and then we have a bunch of different modifiers. And those modifiers were essentially just living in columns, separate columns on different tables. So we have products, and then we have product orders. And so when a product is added to a cart, it creates a product order, which is basically just a join table name, right? So it should be called line items. I don't know, but it's called product orders. And so the price that the user is going to pay for the product gets copied from the pricing field on the product to the product order. And then also the estimated shipping price gets copied over. Also the estimated shipping insurance premium gets copied over. And so you see, it becomes like this, there's just a lot of columns you have to check. Okay. And so then if you think about building a receipt, it's just a lot of surface area, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at, right? You have to know where these columns are at, what they're called. You have to know when you should consider something, when you shouldn't consider something, when you should consult a store setting, or maybe the order shipment's preference. Like, is it a pickup? Because if it's pickup, then shipping shouldn't be considered at all in the price, right? So there's lots of dials and switches, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Is that kind of painting a picture for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely getting a sense of the complexity and just thinking about the edge case as like, what if you add it to your cart and the price changes? What if the user changes the store setting? What if you checked out and you know, obviously you never want the receipt to change, but like, you know, but you still have to honor the store settings in some cases and, and it's going to be different for a product. And what if a sale ends and what if, the user like logs out? I don't even know.
you're getting the picture. There's just lots of adjustments happening in settings to consider. And so the MVP style, how it was kind of made. So, I guess I can back up, and there's been this book I've been reading. It's called SQL Queries for Mere Mortals. And I think it's called Database Design for Mere Mortals. There's two books and, they're pretty good. I'll put links in the show notes, but the original app that we got was sort of like storing computed values in a table. So when you look at a column and it might be called like cost in cents, like you wouldn't think that value should be the result of a math operation like addition or a sum or something in the sort like that, right? You would think that it should be like a unit price and not basically like if you're thinking about view, a computed property has. It is essentially an attribute that it has been computed. So it's not like a raw value, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So the database had these columns in it, and it was very, very hard to reason about because you look at it and you're like, how is this actually derived?
Sure. And in the old Rails way, again, not to knock on Rails, but that would be done pretty straightforward using a callback or a callback hooks, whatever they call them, like a hook, like a before save hook. Like you could, you know, as soon as that model is updated, you could right before you save it, you update all the prices right before they get persisted to the database, and then it's just a simple read operation. Like that's that makes sense to a Rails developer, right? Assuming that nothing else is interpreting that data, right?
Right. And it seems simple up front, and until things get complicated or more complicated, you add more pieces into the mix, then it becomes more difficult because then it's hard to keep it all straight.
Sure.
And one could argue, yeah, you could document it and you know, the person with the domain knowledge would know that, but it's not that easy in practice, I guess, is my counterpoint to that. And so anyway, so like I started reading these books and the author argues like you should never store a computed value in a table. You should always be able to replay it back basically. So in our case, like if you want to build the price of a product, you should be able to replay that and get the correct value back, right? And not have to, I'm trying to think of the specific example he used, but the point he was making was that that's not a great thing to be doing. Like you shouldn't be storing computed values in tables like that. They should be more not pure values, but I can't remember the term I used before. But
well, the canonical example is a bank account, right? Like that's one that everyone understands. Like your bank account balance isn't just a number; it's a sum of every single transaction in a bank account plus like a starting value. Right, which even you could argue the starting value is like initial deposit from zero, right? So like that's kind of, you know, again, that's a money example, but I think that's what people kind of think of, especially when they're talking about, like, you and I talked briefly about event sourcing and kind of what that means and what that would look like. And it sounds like you didn't really decide to go down that path, which I think is totally fine, but it's definitely a common pattern that people, I won't say common, but it's something that people use for this kind of problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, like saying you should be able to replay the numbers back and get a price is along the vein of event sourcing, sort of. It's not like going back to a single point and building the entire price history of a product up. But so I guess where I landed was somewhere in the middle. And so I guess like painting the picture up to this point, it becomes really difficult because there are some base values in the database. There are some computed values in the database. It's not exactly clear unless you have specific domain knowledge on it as to which is which, because the naming isn't, you know, if you're going to use computed properties in there or computed values in there, you should probably like denote that in the name or something. But the naming wasn't clear. So it was just kind of difficult to follow around, right? And one thing that I really, really did not like was the propensity or like this tendency to have to check a setting to after the fact to build a receipt. So if you're building a receipt, you really shouldn't be like going back and checking other settings. And it doesn't matter if a store isn't able to change this thing for a receipt after the fact is still confusing and hard to follow. What you want is you want to just be able to have a column and sum them, like have some data, sum it up, and that's the thing, right? And so the solution I came up with was this idea of price adjustments. And what I ended up doing this week was it's actually ready to go. It's actually ready to go into production. I'm just not shipping it today. But what I ended up doing was products and product orders both now have a column called price adjustments, and those hold a list of structs, which I call price adjustments. And a price adjustment has a type. So the type might be like estimated shipping insurance premium. It could be a discount. It could be anything really. I just have three right now because that's all I needed to consider. They have a title, which is kind of like a more human friendly. So it might be like estimated shipping or UShip shipping insurance policy or something like that. Something that you could actually like show on a receipt, I guess. It has an amount in cents value, and it has a description, which could be more information. It's just text. You could put anything in there. And then it has enabled. And so how it works is that if you have a product and you save it and the dimensions slot it for being shipped by UShip, we actually, in the change set, will go and fetch the rate, which it happens internally. There's no external request there. It happens internally. So we get the rate and we set the estimated shipping rate in a new price adjustment. So it just adds a price adjustment to the list of price adjustments for that product. Now, if you as a store owner decide that you don't want to do the estimated shipping prices anymore and you turn that setting off, what we do is we just queue all your products to be updated. And previously what would happen is when we were building the views, we would say, is this currently on or off? And then consider or not consider that number. But the number was always there. And that was already, I could tell, was going to be difficult because then that's another thing you have to be worried about. And so now when the store changes the setting, it goes and removes the price adjustment for the product. Okay. Are you following that so far?
Yeah. We'll come back to it. I have issue with the enabled field, but
sure.
Finish your thought.
That'll make sense. That'll make sense once we get to product orders. Hopefully it'll alleviate what issue I think you will have with the enable field.
Okay.
Okay. So for products, enabled is pretty much always true at this point. And the reason enabled is on products is because I didn't want to make a product price adjustment and a product order price adjustment, which is something I could pretty easily do if I think I need to.
Oh, a join table, you mean,
yeah,
basically?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
But that's how it works right now. So we're relying on when you change this that our system will get the products updated in a timely fashion. And what's interesting is that after like looking at how's an Amazon, I think Amazon says like, oh, when you make this change, your products might go live in like 15 minutes or 20 minutes or something. So that kind of opened my eyes to, I guess, how bigger systems like that work, because I think like as things get more complex and difficult, I think I would rather rely that if this thing has a price adjustment, then it should have a price adjustment instead of considering the price adjustment, whether or not another related field on a different table is set, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it gives you a lot more flexibility in terms of applying it, like how you apply it, what the conditions are, when you do it. Like it just becomes a problem of synchronization at that
right.
point, like making sure the state is consistent. Because the nice thing about having like a single source of truth for everything is that like you know that it's correct. Whereas this, it's like you've got 10,000 things, and how can you make sure that they're correct? I don't know. It's just a trade off of these like pre-computed versus derived sort of fields. But
yeah. And I'm now after working with after working with it's kind of like a real time I'm just delegating those checks to different times, right? It's not on request time. It happens somewhere else. And then I just am making the bet that, like you said, the state is good here. So if this product has a price adjustment in it, it should have a price adjustment in it. And what that did was, what's funny is that once I made that initial migration, most of the refactoring was actually deleting code.
Oh, sure.
deleting control structures, if else, cond, whatever. It was, most of it was just deleting code, which felt amazing, and it simplified a lot of the stuff. So, okay, so we have products, we have price adjustments. If a product has one, it's assumed that it should have it, right?
And the price adjustments are, did you end up using embedded schemas for this?
Yeah, I ended up using embedded schemas for now. That's, I did that for a specific reason.
Okay.
So you can grill me if you want. I can, yeah.
No, I was just wondering because I didn't know.
Yeah, so I'm just using embedded schemas, and the table itself is, or the column itself is just a JSON column. Yep. And it ended up working pretty well. So we're using Ecto's embedded schemas. I'm using change sets to verify the data is correctly. So I'm verifying that, like, when a type is given, that it's one of the allowed types and stuff like that. So it doesn't feel any different than working with a real table, which is kind of wild.
It's pretty good how Ecto is really good about that.
I mean, it even assigns IDs to the embedded schemas. So each list in the array in the table, or in the field column, sorry, row column. I'm having real, it's Friday night. They all have IDs is what I'm trying to say. Okay. Which is kind of funny. So if you're even looking at, like, if you're looking at Ecto's debugging stuff, you can even say, like, see that it knows that it should just be updating this thing and not completely removing something and adding it, which is kind of wild.
They're GUIs, right? By default?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Okay, so now when you add a product to a cart, what happens is I have the change set, and what it does is it takes the price adjustments that are on the product at that point, and it makes a copy, so it doesn't, like, reference the product's price adjustments, because that'd be bad news, because then your cart would be changing arbitrarily. But it makes a copy of the price adjustments, and those go on to the product orders themselves. And so now at this point, we have a product order with price adjustments, and all price adjustments are enabled. And so this is where the enabled and the enabled flag comes in. So by default, I guess more about the schema. So we have orders, we have product orders, and we have order shipments, okay? So an order shipment is a shipment that belongs to a store and a customer in an order. And so if you're shopping on Design Collective, you can shop from two separate physical locations, two separate entities in one order, okay? And so if you do that, one order has two order shipments. And each order shipment has the product orders that belong to it in that one shipment, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So each order shipment has a preference. It can be pickup or it can be shipped. And by default, they're all assumed to be shipped. And so to paint the picture now, we have an order shipment. It has one product order in it, and the product order has estimated shipping price, and that's enabled. So if you then say, I want to pick this order up, well, then we wouldn't be charging you a shipping price.
Yeah.
So what that does is there's a kind of a... We kind of have a callback stack, I guess. It's just a module with callbacks. And so when an order shipment updates, after the actual order shipment updates itself, it's all in a multi, actually. An operation runs that checks to see what's the preference of this order. If it's pickup, then I'm going to go and disable any estimated shipping type price adjustments for any of the attached product orders and save those product orders, okay? So when you toggle it from ship to pickup, the Rube Goldberg machine goes through and it puts the order shipment in the state that would be correct for pickup. So,
got it. Okay. Yeah. You know what? All right. Clearly you've thought this through. That makes total sense to me. When I see a flag like enabled, I start to sweat.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, enabled why? To whom? What does enabled mean? Does that mean it's visible? Should I call it visible? Like, should it have a better, like, enabled is such like a, it's just a Boolean flag that could mean anything, right? But
it could mean anything, yeah.
But in this case, like, it's pretty straightforward. It's the only Boolean flag you have here. It literally means like, hey, do I apply this to the final price or do I not? And
right.
And when you're summing up the prices, I assume you just filter out the ones that aren't enabled, right?
Exactly.
Depending on the context. So yeah, toggling in the context of a receipt, I can definitely see where that has value. And even like doing a store update, like changing a store-wide setting, you don't have to go in and add and remove prices. You just enable and disable prices that are already there, right? You don't have to recompute everything on the fly. So
Right. And what's even nicer is that the card stuff doesn't need to change, or it shouldn't change when a store changes this stuff. So once it's copied over, it's there. And what's cool is we haven't refactored the discount system to work with this setup, but once we refactor it, the discount system will just insert or remove a price adjustment of type discount.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I tried to make the case for making these price adjustments as real schemas, and I'd put money on the fact that you're probably gonna at some point transition to those 100%. Anyways, instead of embedded schemas.
Yeah,
just because from my personal experience, like it just working with real SQL tables is always just gonna be nice for querying and stuff, but for stuff like example of like copying the stuff over to the receipt, like that's literally like a one line operation. You know, it's just gonna work. Like you don't have to worry about it. Like
oh,
it's just
yeah,
a JSON
yeah.
blob. Stuff like that is really convenient in that case.
So I mean, even though right now a product's price adjustment will always be enabled because there's nowhere in the system that it would be disabled. Because when you opt your store out of it, I mean, I guess I could toggle those to disabled, but right now it just removes them because there's not really a need for them to be there. The only reason why they're disabled on product orders is because that's information I might need to know later, right? So we could glean useful information on different things based off of a price adjustment that was eventually disabled for whatever reason. But for products, it doesn't really matter.
So is the base price still stored on a regular column?
Yeah. So what it used to be was, it was, again, like I said earlier, it was the base price or the sale price plus an estimated shipping if the store has that turned on, plus a shipping insurance premium if the product was like, so we have a couple of rules for insurance. So like if a product is below a certain number, we don't worry about purchasing the thing, right? So then we have to be like, oh, is this, you know, so it's like another optional, like maybe you would configure, like you would consult or use this number in a sum. So it went from like that style setup to the product's price is always either the base or sale plus the sum of the price adjustments, and that's it.
I listened to Full Stack Radio, which is a podcast by Adam Wathen,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote a book, I'm not sure, within the past couple of years, called Refactoring to Collections. And I haven't read it. I think it's a PHP thing, so I don't know how much I would be able to glean out of it. But like, whenever I think of like patterns like you're describing, where basically like a single value is an anomaly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or like the principle is called ZOI, 0, 1, or infinity, where like literally when you're designing something, you should expect to have none of that thing, exactly one of the thing, or an infinite number of that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's no like, oh, well, I just have two of these. Oh, I just have three of these, right? It's always gonna be infinity, right?
That's a wow. Yeah, that just clicked in my mind.
And so, yeah, and it's like, I guess the trick is just, and again, I haven't read Adam's book, but whenever I think of that, like, should just everything be a collection and like singletons are basically the exception, right? Because there's so many times you run into things like, oh, I wish I could just add one more thing. This is like a perfect example of that, where you should, it's just, you can't anticipate all the, you know, computers are really good at enumerating things. Like,
turns out,
like,
yeah.
Humans are not. Computers, they'll just do it. They'll do it all day. That's all they do. They just run loops.
Yeah. I can't tell you how much better, like, I just feel looking at things, or how much better I felt when I was just deleting if the setting is available. Preload this setting, and then if it's available, else do this other thing. And it's just, I could probably even refactor it down to a sale price being a price adjustment, but that would be a much larger thing. So I only did the shipping updates on this one. I didn't include the discounts or trade user discounts or anything like that, because it would just balloon and keep going. So yeah, I guess I refactored it from a collection of scattered out columns to, it's literally just a thing. And so the price that you get is the base price plus the sum of these things. And it's like I said, I can't remember what the diff was now, but it mostly, it was actually just deleting code. it was mostly deleting like conditionals that were making things complex. So it feels much, much better. And it feels really good because this is exactly what I was talking about last week when I was like, I should have done this. I should have realized this earlier and I should have refactored it to be what I'm describing right now. And it feels really, really good to actually have that done. And it feels kind of like a weight off because there's numbers of things with this code base that I just want to fix and I haven't been able to get to. And this was one of those things and it just feels, I don't know, it feels really good.
And you just, it's just a week, man. I mean, it was a long week, but
it was a long week.
Just a week.
And what's funny that is that this, the service area for this change is almost exactly the same as the one that I shipped last week. It's just severely like less complicated than last week's was. So testing it was easier. Like click testing it was easier. The automated tests were easier. It was just, it was a long week, but it was, I don't know, it was just good. It was just a good week. And it, I don't know, it feels good. It feels really good. But yeah, that I didn't necessarily mean for that to be like a feature breakdown of how pricing works on Design Collective, but I guess it was.
That's all right. You've been wanting to talk about that for a while, and I'm glad you actually like found something that, that works. And be curious over the next couple of months how that actually works out for you. You know, like do you find any shortcomings with it, or does it just do what you want? How extensible is it really?
Like you said, it'll probably eventually be a table for for querying reasons or for things like that, right? It won't stay a JSON column forever, but I think like in this case, it'll be easy enough to refactor to that point. And so like you mentioned extractions earlier, I guess like changing this from a JSON column to a table, a full-blown table, isn't necessarily an abstraction, but I got what I needed out of the refactor without having to go that extra step, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And like in college, my major was computer engineering, which is like this weird mix of like, it's halfway between electrical and computer science, basically. And yeah, I mean, I took courses on like design patterns and stuff. The Gang of Four book, object-oriented design, right? It's all like lots of Java, basically. Mm-hmm. And like it's stuff you can read about over and over again, and everything has a name. But without this kind of like practical experience of like, oh, I need to use this thing here, this pattern or this abstraction that's going to basically make things interchangeable. That's just comes with time and experience. And it can be frustrating when you'd like have to kind of figure it out and struggle through not recognizing the pattern and implementing it. But man, it's satisfying when the code actually just is structured nicely.
Yeah, it feels so much nicer. It's easier to think about. It doesn't like, I don't sit in my room at night and wonder about or think about, it really did before. Like some of this stuff really just kind of weighs in my mind. And so I know we kind of need to wrap it up, but one thing I started doing this week was just setting a hard stop of work at 5. So when it hits 5 o'clock, unless there's an emergency, I'm not working anymore. And that's been really hard for me because, and this is something I talked to a friend, Dave, that I was mentioning earlier. We kind of talked about this a little bit, was if you're working on a small team like that, the pressure to just keep working and the pressure to do all this stuff is, it just kind of pushes you into just keep working, right? Keep moving, keep pushing. And it's not been healthy, I guess. And so that was one of the things that we talked about at Design Collective, was the pace was too fast. We're moving too fast. We're doing too much stuff. And Lindsay was like, I get it. So I said, I think I'm going to do a hard stop at 5. At 5 o'clock, I'm done unless it's an emergency. And she said, that's great. And she even brought it up on the team call today. And she said, everybody, I think we should consider doing this. If you have a time where you just want to be done, then just stop then and let everyone know what that is and let that become part of the culture.
And if you start messaging me stuff on Discord about work on Saturday, I'm going to yell at you.
I can work on non-Design Collective things. Lindsay will never know because none of you will tell her.
As long as they're fun projects.
Yeah, as long as they're fun projects. But anyway, thanks for letting me rant about that, because it was another, I was talking to another, my other friend Blizzle, friend of the show Blizzle, and he was talking about how it can be intimidating, like talking about decisions you've made and things that you've built, and how there's like this push, especially if you're sharing it publicly, for it to be perfect. And he's like, how can you possibly learn and grow under that sort of feeling? And so for me, it was kind of like I said, I didn't really want to talk about the pricing stuff because it wasn't how I wanted it to be. And it's closer now, and so I feel a little bit better talking about it, but still a little bit insecure, to be honest, because I'm sure other people will be like, oh, you could just do this, or you could just do that, you know? But
and no one's looking over your shoulder at your code, though. You're fine. Open source is a whole different thing.
They might be. Anyhow, yeah, thanks for letting me ramble about that.
No, it's good. I've been curious to hear how that developed, so
yeah,
good to hear. Actually, it's actually good we didn't talk, because now I get to... You got to give me the full download.
Well, when did we talk about, was it last week? I started talking about the price adjustment idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess we didn't talk at all this week. Well, I did it. It's done. I can show you some code.
Good job.
It's actually way simpler than I thought it would be. So, yeah. Anyhow, I guess if anyone wants to let me know what they think about price adjustments and that idea, hit me up on Twitter.
Where can they find you on Twitter, Sean?
That's at Sean Washbot.
Or you can tweet at the show, at DNC Show. I'm Schrockwell on Twitter, S-C-H.
S-C-H, that's right. I spell it wrong all the time, and I feel really bad about it.
It's okay, you should.
I should feel bad about it. Show notes are available at dnc.show.
.show.
I haven't finished the new site yet, I'm sorry. I was busy building price adjustments and sleeping.
You're just playing. New stuff you got going on is cool.
Shout out to Gridsome for hitting us up and following us and liking the last episode. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was cool. We're always hanging out on spectrum.chat where we'll post show notes and you can talk to us in real time about any questions, comments, discussions. We're there.
We are there. And always thanks to Spec for having us. And shout out to the new show on the network, React Podcast. You should definitely check that out if you're into React or interested in it or just want to listen to another developer podcast. Again, that's React Podcast and we want to welcome them to the network.
Yeah, that's awesome. This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. Well, we'll see. We'll see what next week brings, shall we?
Another refactor of... I'm just kidding.
Refactor every day.
Yeah. I have 3 months to focus solely on that stuff, so we'll see what happens next.
Okay.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
See you later. Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Don't wait for your users to report errors. Iterate faster on your application, improve the user's happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at Sentry.io.